Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Macro Edge Spaces via X. This is a pre-recorded program from Friday, March 22nd, 2024. Please tune in next Friday for the official start of Macro Edge After Dark. The program will debut live at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on March 29th. We join the program already in progress.
Well, it's like we've all said, people are starved for reality, and all they get is nothing but garbage from every news media source on the face of the earth. And here we are all discussing the realities of the situation that we see. I think everybody wants that. They need that. It's nobody else is doing it.
Yeah. The industry I'm in, we see a lot of reality that doesn't get disclosed until the 10-Ks float out. And it gets somewhat interesting because I get a little bit different perspective as I'm on the end of the luxury side of the market, and another major hack this week, very little coverage. Another company went and they're in trouble. Their financials got hit, but not anything where they could access funds, but their order and production systems plus distribution systems were taken down pretty hard.
I think there's going to be a lot more of that where in every industry. I mean, there was just a case in Minnesota about something similar to that, basically scooping an email for contractors and taking the money from draw payments, putting it to a Capital One account, and neither the developer nor the contractor has any idea where the money's at.
Holy cows. We're seeing more and more of this craziness also with regards to companies paying ransoms or thinking they're paying ransoms, and they're going to other hackers who are intercepting it.
Yeah, I've seen that recently. And after making a payment, everybody's wondering where the money's at. It's the Wild West.
It's getting crazy. And it was predictable. It was totally predictable because while they hardened their financial and payment systems, they failed to sit there and harden production, logistics, et cetera. And most of these corporations have back doors that are so wide open. I mean, it cost Clorox $150 million to fix their computers, not counting lost sales.
Which affects the bottom line at some point.
Yeah, and it really makes you wonder what the quality of the situation at Boeing is. They handled when they acquired McDonnell Douglas, it was a terrible murder. It was one of the worst mergers in the industry, and it's been downhill ever since. And they put all their efforts into defense, and now they're not even producing quality defense products. It's a terrible situation for America because Airbus is mocking us, of all people. The French are mocking us. If you look at the overseas media, it's mind-blowing.
I haven't seen that, but I have no doubt. I think the whole situation with Boeing has been 25 years in the making, and it's the natural conclusion to what should have been resolved, you know, back in the dot-com, which we're seeing that play out all over the place.
Yeah, and unfortunately for America, we don't seem to have a comprehensive program for a diversified aerospace industry. And that's terrifying.
Well, the flip side to that is anybody who wants to get an airplane has to go through a lot more security than they have to get for aerospace program. I don't know what to say about that, but priorities.
Yeah. I enjoy that so much. It has definitely been a major problem for everyone, and they are not anywhere close to resolving it. And as you saw in Moscow tonight, we don't even have the kind of security around our shopping malls, our inner cities. It's a god-awful situation when you start adding it all together. We're ripe for other problems, that proverbial black swan swooping in and creating economic chaos.
Well, it's like we were discussing in the group earlier. We've got states that are using National Guards for different situations, from repelling foreign national citizens to dealing with citizens getting on subways. There's instability across the system right now that I don't think anybody's taking into account the macro landscape and the implications that that has.
Totally agree. I don't think anyone understands why or where people, they fail to take into account, I should say, let me phrase this properly. They fail to take into account external events as impacts and the impacts on markets, and basic commercial transactions are at risk. What we take for granted is at high risk.
There's a lot of truth to that.
And I don't know why my volume all of a sudden tanked when you spoke. That's interesting. We'll play with settings while we're doing this because there's something weird going on. Captions, no. Sound effects or options?
What do you have for sound effect options?
That's a good question. Let's find out. Unfortunately, that's one of those things that I love to play with. It says sound effect options. Let's see. No. I am playing with this right now.
Let's open it up to Daxilla 6. Anybody got something to say?
Speak up, guys. Everyone's quiet. Well, go ahead, guys. Go ahead, 6.
Yeah, so I thought this week was a shit show, to be honest with you. Powell really should have pushed back against those inflation reports and did not. And I think the next one is pretty sure to be hot because of that. And then it's going to get really interesting after that, I think. Because what's he going to do really next? You know, like what's the next report is probably going to be hot too. And then he can't ignore it. And then we'll really see if he is, for lack of a better word, totally cucked by Yellen.
An interesting dynamic going on with the government right now, isn't it? We've got monetary policy fighting fiscal policy, and it seems to be a tug of war that no one's willing to give up.
Yeah. I see these videos of, like, I don't know if you guys saw the video of Congress doing some kind of line dance this week. I don't even know if the video was from this week, but I saw that and I was like, are you kidding me? This is how they choose to spend their time. I don't know why that's not the main issue. The just them talking about the budget. Like, I wonder how many years we are away from some chainsaw-wielding guy like Javier Milei. How many years away we are from something like that?
I think that's a very good point that you bring up, because I think everybody that pays attention to markets and to our we'll call it monetary policy, can see that there is a risk of some extreme deflationary event that could take place and could wipe out the financial landscape as we know it. So that lurks out there. I think everybody has a sense of that in some way or another. But then the lack of reality that representatives are dealing with on a daily basis. And it's not hard to see why Milei came to power in Argentina or where that could happen elsewhere.
I wonder, when I look at the chart of the SPX and it's just going like straight up 1,100, 1,200 points, if it's really because of, you know, people think, oh, soft landing, everything's going to be fine, or if it's
because of people thinking that they've just given up on the fight against inflation. They've accepted that the Treasury is just going to dump, you know, roundabout like fiscal QE instead of monetary QE into the market, because that's basically what they're doing right now, or a mixture of both. And I'm not really sure. I can't really wrap my head around it.
That's an interesting point. And I think that there's maybe there's legitimate concerns there.
Yeah.
But then think about the market dynamics of the funding. Professor Plum has done a great job discussing this concept of passive flows, right? As long as people are employed and they're putting money in their 401ks and there's a match, the stock market volumes are going to increase until something in that changes, or until we recognize that there's a recession and people that need to access the capital that's been put there go somewhere else. So I kind of view it like the reality of the stock market is that is literally the last domino to fall, even after unemployment increases happen. Because that's when people will need to get the capital out of the market.
Yeah, that's true. You got 6% of every person's paycheck in this country basically going right into the market.
Exactly. I mean, at least the majority of the population.
Yeah, yeah.
Which makes it tough because, you know, let's say you're trading, that's your living. What are you supposed to do with that reality? We've all discussed the idea of the greater pool. But if that's how you're making your living, you don't just give up and say, okay, well, I'm done participating. I'm going to go change careers now.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
And then you dig in, you know, and that's where it pays to understand the daily swings and trades and things that affect daily outcomes, because that's where you make your money.
Yeah. So you guys know I do this for clients, and my biggest thing that I try to overcome when I take on new clients now, and it really bugs me, is that I know that these clients that I have, you know, they've got a 30-year horizon on this money, right? And that the best place for people with, you know, 30 plus years until retirement for them to put it is in equities. But I also have just a fundamental problem internally of just slamming buy on the S&P at 5,200. So that's a daily struggle that I'm having right now. And it's hard. It's hard to do it.
Yeah. I can only imagine the challenge in that. It's like, how do you escape the situation where there's, not to say easy money, but where you're seeing the growth,
right?
And I mean that, but how do you mitigate the risk of it also?
I'm trying to keep people's money. I'm doing a lot of like T-bills, definitely doing equities because you have to, but I'm doing a lot of T-bills with the intention of when it looks like it's going to get dicey, I'm going to buy 2-year. And that's my plan. I'm going to do that for myself too with leverage, obviously not in the client portfolios with leverage, but
that's not a bad plan though. That's kind of a historical context approach to take of it too, isn't it? Right? Like the gambler comes to mind and the scene that Don shared with us a few times, but really, like, that resonates. It comes from a place of FU. Everybody knows what you pay, 2.5, you know?
You
drive a, you know, an inexpensive Japanese import, and you put the rest into treasuries and 2-3%.
Yeah.
That's actually good financial advice.
It's fantastic financial advice.
I mean, that's the great thing about it. And then, you know, somebody asks you to do the job you don't want to do, F you.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Oh, yeah.
I've got to throw this in here. If you notice the volumes this week, there was no commitment to any of these moves.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true.
You can worry about that, John. Will you tell us more about the volume?
Yeah.
Well, what we saw was a decline after the NYSE and NASDAQ posted up over 8 billion shares on OPEX last Friday. We never broke 5.5-6 million any day this week in the NASDAQ, and not even close to 5 billion on the NYSE. Today was pathetic. Everybody went on vacation for a week. So there's no money in the market now. It's just the kids. It's just the interns.
In other words,
so next week will be one of the slowest 4-day work weeks for the market that you've ever seen.
In other words, this week was more about the retail side, the amateur day traders, rather than any real money.
Precisely. And next week will be the same thing, because the big money is on. They got on their planes and their yachts and they hauled out. They're down in Florida. They're out in the Caribbean. They're in St. Barts.
So my question is, how do we join them?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, see, Mega Millions is a billion tonight. So if you didn't buy your tickets, oh, well. But on a more serious note, this market is going to play wide and loose for the next 10 days, next 7 to 10 days. They're not going to come back till April.
Yep.
Well, it seems too, like y'all were saying, it's not that the market's found a top. It's like there's not as much exuberance as it continues to go up. Like 5,000 was something, 5,100 was something. And then what, 40, 50, 60 days, it hit 5,200?
Exactly.
I just can't believe the shape of this rally. I've never seen anything like it. I haven't been trading for that long. Like, not for decades, certainly, but I just can't believe the shape of it. It's like straight up with no substantial pullbacks at all. It's insane to me.
There's something I saw. It was a chart. It's either 95, 96, or 97 that did something similar to that. One of those years it just went straight up.
Like, even during COVID, when they were buying over $100 billion in treasury and corporate bonds, not even then did the chart look like this. Like, this is just something else.
This is all the money that the Fed's trying to burn out of the system.
Yeah.
I mean, people say, I think that there could have been $200 trillion worth of wealth created out of that money they printed during COVID, because they just printed it out of thin air and then people made money out of thin air with it.
I don't know
you
how
got
they...
all these zombie companies that are existing that, you know, they turned into $100 billion companies again out of thin air, and then just can keep printing shares and printing money.
Well, keep in mind, we've seen this before.
Oh, I know.
If you remember that article I put up several weeks ago called Sysvidia, 99-2000, it was the Eiffel Tower all over again.
And it'll fall, but like you were talking about, you never know. You don't want to miss out on this rally. But at some point, it's going to stop.
Well, that's where the ETFs are handy. And you don't have to go into direct shorts or risky options. You can just play the short ETFs, have tight stops, get out when you get blown out, re-enter when you feel comfortable.
I don't know if you guys got to check out that podcast that I posted this week, but it was really good. And one of the best points that I got from it it was something that I already knew, but it was a good reminder to get, was he was talking about like when you want to play a move in something, that you want to be in the direct corollary of that move, like not trying to play around it, but directly like playing the thing that's going to directly benefit from it. Like if you expect the economy to take a steep downturn, the move is not to short the stock markets, because you don't know what the stock market's going to do, because the Fed could step in with some kind of accommodative policy to buoy the market, or they could not, but you really don't know. But what you can be freaking sure of is that if rates are high and the economy takes a dive, that they're going to lower those rates.
So that means bonds, short the front end of the curve, the principal prices are going to go up. And I like that.
Well, I'm firmly convinced that we're going to have some sort of commercial real estate related event in the next 60 days. And that's going to force the Fed to engage in the cut, give them the cover, I should say, for a major cut in June, minor cut July, and staying put until after the election. I just can't see the regional banks holding up the way that they're bleeding right now.
Totally agree. It's like more than one a day now that we're seeing like a pretty large office building default.
Go ahead, Mr. Austin. If I can get him. Oh, there we go. Let me get him on here. Approved. There we go. Now I've got him here.
Welcome aboard, Mr. Austin.
I'm back again. I think you bring up some interesting points there about commercial real estate. They're kind of inescapable realities, right? Lenders have already lent on real estate that is no longer performing. They can extend and they can pretend as much as they want to until they can't, because at some point, the money ceases to be worth its current value, right? I mean, the rent, the net operating income keeps getting dragged down. And it's kind of a tale as old as time. And it's never just the operator that's affected. The lender gets affected. The lender's business gets affected. That affects everybody else. It's not a new concept, and it gets treated as though it's something that is a one-off every time. But it's just how the market has always worked, and it always will, because of how lending works.
Now, well, nobody wants to take the chance of, you know, their property being worth less, and a lot of the property, you know, it's being secured by other property. It's a domino system once it starts falling.
Oh, it's 100%. It's always been that way. It's always a domino system, because once one property starts underperforming, it's like an illness. They all start underperforming, and it's not something that nobody could have seen coming. It's a bunch of operators get excited about the opportunity to buy something at a lower leverage basis than they're used to or thought was worthwhile, but it's really still over leverage. And then leverage fails, and you know what happens when the lever comes back down on the person holding it.
What's more interesting, in my opinion, is the fact that the refinancing is starting now in commercial real estate. And in my travels throughout Florida, I'm seeing a lot more industrial space wide open and a lot of the mini storages. I think we've overbuilt that again also. So when you start adding in multifamily residential, industrial, and I guarantee you we will see automotive lots popping up into this problem soon because of the default rate on subprime auto. We're going to start seeing car dealerships close and fail all over the country.
100%. And then, again, it didn't get as much attention the last couple of recessions, but that's always been the case. It's always there's no industry, no subsector of real estate that gets spared. It's just different degrees. But to your point, and I think a lot of us in the group have flown enough where how many times have you taken a flight and you've seen literally acres of industrial buildings built and half of them are empty? And the industrial vacancy rate has already climbed back up to 6%. And everybody wants to act like industrial is a darling, but industrial construction spending has already peaked and is declining. Manufacturing, 100% of manufacturing as an industry. So the subsectors all in, you know, rolled up into all manufacturing. The revenues have declined from 2022 to 2023. So industrials, especially small storages,
it's affected. There's no way it's coming out unscathed. It's impossible.
And the problem that people are overlooking, despite the income distribution, a lot of the lower income strata was living on the government aid that started with COVID. And now that well has run dry, which means they can have no access to credit at all. And that is going to kill the so-called low-end housing market and the vacation market, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, one of the articles I'm working on, I'm pulling back an article from 2022 where people were going into buy now, pay later arrangements for their trips to Disney World. Think about that, the consequences of that. And roll that into the current economy where you're seeing interest rates above 31% for credit cards for the high-risk individuals.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. I think there, that is part and parcel of the same situation. You know, all credit really is the business cycle in the United States of America. And it starts with mortgages and credit cards, and auto loans are only part of that. But once credit can't expand anymore, credit contracts. And once credit contracts, Americans' ability to spend contracts. So we're seeing it in housing. We're seeing it in construction spending. We're seeing it in the revenues that have affected all but 15 sub-industries in the United States up until end of fourth quarter last year. And now we're starting to see it even in retail, which has been so far, even though it's talked about as though, you know, the consumer continues to be strong. What are they going to do? How many consumers farm anymore? How many of them have gardens? How many of them are going to stop spending money on groceries and clothing and make it themselves? It's not how anything works anymore.
No, the consumers.
Now, when these commercial real estate properties come up for renewal on their loans and they're getting appraised, do you guys know if they're appraising them based on like comp sales or based on what? Because that should be a problem with the refinancing, but you know, when is that going to start to take effect? Because most of these properties should be worth 30-40% less than they are, but is that going to reflect in the appraisal, or that's something that I'm not sure.
It's already affected in the appraisals, and I think that's part of why you're starting to see CreditIQ and some other companies, even CoStar, starting to post the realities of properties having been sold at 30% of market value because of the appraisal. And part of it is based on the property's condition, but the good thing about commercial property, right, it's not a complete magic formula like it is in residential where you go, oh, well, your neighbor's house appraised at this and you have one less or one more bedroom. You have to take into account the actual revenue that's generated with the property and its condition and name. So when the revenue starts disappearing, it's going to affect the appraisal value of a commercial property.
And add in the fact that there's a lot of commercial property trapped in retail locations, the great strip mall buildup of Florida, et cetera. It's just going to deteriorate at an accelerated pace. And the cost of the refi is going to kill these small businesses. Absolutely just murder them.
100%. And therein lies the problem with a good portion of every cycle of real estate is, you know, we've talked about the idea of business cycles, about manias, right? There's smart money, and then there's just everybody hoping to jump on the train. The reality is that time value of money exists no matter who you are, where you are, how you are, what you are. It's inescapable, right? If you're not planning for cost to go up with value, then who cares if the value of the property goes up? Because it costs you more money to operate it. They're tied together like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. You can't escape one from the other.
I'm going to be curious to see what happens with the auto layoffs and the impacts, especially those who built specifically to accommodate this EV craze, because I view that as just another bubble mania. And I'm going through the history of some of our recent bubbles. I've already started digging into the diet pill bubble for Ozempic, et cetera. This is not anything new, by the way. Just like the artificial intelligence bubble, just like the EV bubble. And what was it?
My response to the Ozempic is Weight Watchers and Jen and Craig have existed for a lot longer.
Exactly. The scary part, the ARTO 5-year tests for those drugs being used as weight loss drugs. There is no 5-year test record or test bed even established from what I understand.
We could make a lot of people angry if we started talking about test realities and drugs, you know?
I'll just leave it at, I don't miss my days working with FDA compliance. When I did a little consulting at the turn of the century, it was terrifying. And the two companies that were the worst would not be a surprise to anybody.
But with those drugs, don't they want people to be on them for the rest of their life? And it's supposed to have all these magical things happen to them. But if they stop, isn't it in the literature that you're going to gain the weight back if you stop taking the pills?
Oh, yeah. For sure.
Oh, it's not a pill. It's a shot in your leg.
Well, they're doing the shot now. They'll get to a pill as their plan.
Yeah. But they're not talking about the consequences to your system. Some people are suffering kidney and liver damage. There's other intestinal issues that are developing. It's not a universal medication for everyone. And there's such a rush to get these to market. It's scary from the perspective. Once again, we're not looking at 5 and 10 year data to sit there and say, we won't have a massive outbreak of a different kind of cancer or a different kind of heart issue, et cetera. Without that test data, without that, the patients involved in constant reporting, blood testing, et cetera, I don't like the safety parameters, to be honest.
Well, you bring up some interesting points, and I'm glad that Kat is on the test spaces here as well.
Well, you made me join, and I apologize for having a really hoarse voice.
It's okay.
As I told you, I had a very long trip. I was in Texas all week. So Austin, excuse me, San Antonio and Houston. But I've been in the restaurant business for too many years. I don't want to share. But when I think about the only thing I can say to Ozempic, throughout my career, we've had the gluten-free, craze. We've had, clean food, all of those types of things. And so I'll tell you, at least from the restaurant space or the food and beverage space, none of us talk about Ozempic. It might be in headlines, but that's not a factor that any of us talk about.
I think that's realistic.
Way overboard when they start relating, projecting it for, like, I see them project forward towards candy sales and stuff. And I when I see that stuff, that's just nonsense, honestly.
You know what the Ozempic reminds me of? You remember the Vioxx, the pain pill that gave all the people heart attacks? So they had like the almost $5 billion settlement. Back in the mid-2007s, feel like it's going to be a lot like that, except a lot more expensive.
Well, when you look at how they are approving medications without long-term risk profiles, and there are other solutions, Kat's spot on. People are going, this drug is designed to let you eat the way you've always been eating. You just don't have a hunger for as much. So if you have a hunger for eating potato chips, chocolate bars, and sodas all day, you can still eat them, just not in the same quantities. It's idiotic. It's not healthier.
Yeah, it's an appetite suppressant. And the thing about it is, anyone that I know that is on Ozempic, they're still coming to get ice cream. They're just not eating as much.
That actually makes sense. And I don't see people giving up their favorite cheeseburger just because they've got their own Ozempic. They'll just skip breakfast, or they'll skip fruits or something else. It's a scary proposition, because you're not training someone to be self-disciplined on the contents of their diet. You're simply saying, hey, we've got a cure, eat whatever you want, even though you can still wolf down 900 other items that will clog your heart, your arteries, and everything else.
We got more listeners. Welcome aboard, everybody. We lost Kat. She's reconnecting. Well, basically, welcome, everybody. This is just a test podcast as we get our act together and prepare for a debut for Macro Edge starting next week.
John, you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. Can you hear me? You still have me here?
That's weird.
Six, can you hear me? I think, I don't know if you can hear me or not.
I can hear you.
Oh, very good. Thanks, Axilla.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is a strange time that we're in, where we're having a culmination of various bubbles all occurring at the same time. And that's what's weird. I don't know how it keeps getting booted.
That is bizarre.
No, I think a lot of people have seen this slowdown coming, and that's why nobody, again, this year wants to say that anything's happening, because last year it kind of slowed down and then it picked up. But now we're almost in April, and we haven't seen it picking up. We've seen the layoffs go up. We've seen the companies close down. We've seen things slow down. But then if you watch the news, everything's great because the newcomers are coming.
Well, this is the statement we've been pushing here on Macro Edge. The BLS is promoting absolute BS statistics with revisions on an annualized basis, which show that we've had a massive slowdown in hiring, et cetera. Sure. Add in what's going on with real estate in several states teetering on the edge of disaster. And this is where Six and Mr. Awesome and everybody can step in and talk about their local areas. And when you see the big picture from this.
What trades are you guys out on right now?
Oh, that's easy. I'm treasuries and precious metals.
Cash.
Pretty much, yeah.
Anything more ambitious than that?
Only my own line of work. That's kind of some real estate deals that I'm hoping to turn within the next few months, but that's based on way different market dynamics than what I've witnessed everybody else take part in, right? I mean, there's overbuilding, and everybody knows that I talk about building, and that's kind of my trade. But there's also opportunities out there that nobody is discussing, and I'm not going to give all those away for free, but there's still markets in the United States that are healthy. There's places and opportunities for business to grow and thrive, and for real estate, for restaurants, where you name it. It's just people just have to do the homework. It's like the we were talking about earlier, Six, right? That if you think, you know, SPACs are going to go to 6,000, then how do you navigate that? It's the different pieces that go together with it. You know, in real estate, it's markets, demographics are good. They're growing. They haven't participated so far in bubbly prices. And there's opportunity to build things that people need and want. So from that standpoint, you know, it's really not rocket science. It's basically just not trading in what everybody else is trading in my world anyways, which is, you know, right, sometimes way different from the stock market. We were discussing, and I posted that chart yesterday, of the industries in the United States. All but 15 of them are negative year over year in net revenues from 2022. And one of those huge industries is technology, or, you know,
information of which NVIDIA is a part of. So they really kind of are holding up the U.S. economy from going into recession for now. But recession, like war, life goes on, right? So, yes, it's terrible. There's an enormous amount of people that get affected by it. But it's not everybody, and life goes on. And that's what are you supposed to do? You can't stop life because a good portion of the world doesn't function the way it's supposed to.
Right. And especially with NVIDIA, the thing that I wonder about, and obviously if you think that NVIDIA price is too high, there's a million better ways to express that than to short NVIDIA, you know. But I really wonder. Yeah, like I see so many people that are trying to short NVIDIA. Like, don't pick up pennies in front of a steamroller. That's nonsense. But I wonder really how much of their recent earnings and maybe even the next couple quarters has been companies, just pulling forward their CapEx and just stocking up on processing power. But then, you know, they have all that they need and they don't need to get more.
Well, that's the reality, right? That's
right.
I'll liken that to home building. D.R. Horton Lennar, right? And the two of them are so big that they make more than the next five or six home builders combined. Like, I'm not going to short them. I think they're going to have troubles, but they're sitting on an awful lot of cash and they're the revenue positive of the group. But at some point, they're going to have trouble because how many more people are there buying brand new houses, especially with the prices that we have today combined with the rates that we have today.
Yeah.
Well, we still have Lakewood Ranch, so that should answer your question.
There really is a wave of people that are just waiting for rates to come down to buy houses. Like, I see it every day dealing with clients that people are literally just standing on the sidelines waiting for rates to come down to buy houses. Mm-hmm. And all of the mortgage industry is just chirping in their ear, talking about, you know, when rates come down, we could do this and this and this. And all the realtors and mortgage brokers are just salivating, waiting for the rate cuts. And all of these people are just waiting to do
it. Which is interesting, right? Because everyone talks about it being the rates. Nobody ever talks about it being the prices, but let's say the new home costs $100. How many houses do you think would get sold? Right? We're talking about things that get put into a state of mania, right? And people say, oh, well, especially if my mortgage is 2.37%, sure, I can afford the payment on it. But how many people really, and we know this because we've got data going back 100 years that says only about a third of the population can actually buy their home in cash. Everybody else has got to afford it on payments. Well, price is 100% of the problem. And secondary to that problem is the interest rate and how much they can pay for that home based on how much they make. Well, if what people are making is going down, if their industry is going down, if the rates are going up, then we've got a recipe for there's unlimited demand, unlimited want for something better. That will never change. But it's not going to change people's ability to pay the prices that we have today. And at the end of the day, if the price every month is all that matters, we're so far away from what reality can hold. There's nowhere to go but down, in my opinion, even with the demand.
Exactly. And I mean, if you look at the chart of median household prices to median income, I mean, housing's never been more expensive on that basis, ever. So,
agreed. Yeah, 100%. Never.
I mean, something's got to change, and I don't think it's going to be incomes.
Yeah, well,
not at a pace to keep up with the price of houses and standardized inflation measures. You're not going to see that happen overnight. It's impossible.
And if we do, let's just say everyone's salaries, increase by the 70% necessary to make the payments.
What does that say about our monetary system, and what is that going to do to inflation in and of itself?
It's the question I have, because when you look at the big picture, we're going to tolerate a little bit of inflation for the rest of this year. That's the debate
situation for sure.
Plain as day by Mr. Powell. He could care less about the lower and lower middle class. It's going to be about maintaining the ability of those with the salaries to buy a new home, to buy a new car, to keep some level of economic growth moving forward. I got into an interesting discussion with an insurance broker today. They were talking about California losing State Farm, which was an amazing thing to see happen, I believe, in my opinion. But what made it bad, I don't know what that, John, where you at? Oh, you can't hear me?
Yeah, we
can. Uh-oh. Okay, you can. Okay, I just want to make sure. What was amazing is no one is taking into account, as property values skyrocket, insurance has to go with it. You have more to insure, so of course your insurance rates are going to go up. It's the same for Florida. It's the same for anywhere that's had a boom. And people think that they can keep old insurance rates on their home because they bought it 10 years ago. It doesn't work that way. And I can't seem to get that through the heads of these people. Your rates are naturally going to follow the value of your property.
Six, this is something that you and I, we've touched on, right? All of the, you know, analysts that get employed, they're doing what they're supposed to do. They're discounting cash flow, right?
Yeah.
Because that's what you should do, is discount cash flow because of that concept, right? Okay, say prices rise, which they don't always, but let's just say they do. Well, cost is going to rise too. So whatever increase is offset by the decrease. That's the nature of economics and money. It's inescapable. So if you're not modeling your 500 key hotel room to also have increased cost as well as increased value in the future, well, then you're one of the casualties we're reading about in CreditIQ and CoStar and across the board, going, we don't have the money, we don't have the resources, we don't know what happened, it's not us, it's the economy, it's the unforeseen conditions. But really, that's just how money works. And it always has been and always will be, and no one can change that reality.
Right. I don't know what they were thinking bidding some of these commercial real estate properties to like a 3 cap on loans that are floating rate. Like, I don't know what they were thinking doing that. It just literally makes no sense to me. Like, they were asking
for it. Shed some light on that, because that question is something that I hold near and dear. Yeah. And it frustrates me, because it actually affects all of us. But when you have syndications, right? So Alexei Chernobylevsky has been great at discussing this concept in limited partners and general partners. But the concept of, if I, as a person, can raise money from, say, 10 people and model something to show values only go up, and the passive investor goes, okay, here's my money. Well, what is the risk reward involved there? The general partner, right? It's like the 2 in 20 in fund management.
Yeah.
They get 2 in 20 no matter what your money does. If it disappears, they get 2 in 20. If it grows, they get 2 in 20. So the GP is the fund manager. They might not have any skin in the game whatsoever, but let's just say that they do. Every year, the amount of interest that they accrue in the property grows. So if they have any upside, then they get more money as a percentage of the revenue on the upside. So it's literally heads they win, tails they win, regardless of what you do. So of course, we get the situation we have now, which is, we've overbuilt everything. We're incentivized to overbuild everything because of the fund structure, and nobody ever questions it. And I'm not saying it's good or bad. It's not a judgment. It's just a
quality of real estate.
So heads the property that's at a 3 cap just appreciates in value, and the GP does well. Tails, it doesn't appreciate, and the LPs just get screwed.
Exactly. Right? Like heads, it appreciates. They can cash out refi. They can sell it at a higher rate. They get their percentage increase in ownership on top of their 2 and 20. Tails, it doesn't. Sorry, guys, your capital's vaporized, but I got my 2 and 20. Have fun. And that is the reality of the real estate market as far as syndication goes. That's just simple truth.
Yep.
And needless to say, we've seen a lot of very bad.
Awesome. You were the one who analyzed that real estate deal I sent, right?
Yes, sir. That was I.
Yeah. My buddy was not happy with the notes I gave him. Yeah, I kind of know. But you already knew
that. Oh, I did. I knew when I sent it to you that whoever you shared it was not going to be happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's an interesting scenario in my real life situation of a developer who wanted me to partner on a development deal. And interesting enough, our families have known each other for a very long time. But the development deal that he sent along, and this is one of the things that I do every day, I stress test developments, right? So let's say you get top of market rent, top of market sales, whatever. What does 0.5% interest rate change do to the deal? What is a 2% decrease in rent revenue due to the deal? Because if you don't stress test it for real life scenarios, like I don't know how everybody else operates other than I've been through enough cycles now where I keep watching people don't, and then like we keep having real estate disasters. But the reality is, right? So running these stress tests, he was pretty frustrated to begin with, but then he changed his mind and was very grateful that he understood that maybe the situation of his pitch deck wasn't real. And maybe he should look at different scenarios and different solutions to the situation he found. And we've had a very good relationship since. But not everybody's like that, right? But, I mean, that's the reality about real estate investments. If you're going to invest as a partner with somebody, why would you not stress test that? Why would you not make sure that, you know, 2% decrease in rents doesn't go from a, hey, cool, we're all making money too. Oh my God, everything we put into it just got wiped out. Because that's real. We're seeing CreditIQ report stuff that's a 9% debt service coverage ratio.
Like, yeah, that's insane. How did that even get
approved? To put that in context, that means if you're making $100,000 of net operating income, if you have $100,000 debt service, you only have $9,000 of net operating income to pay the $100,000 of debt service. Like,
how does that $9,000
to $100,000 debt payment? But
right,
that's where we're at. We're at the point where the mania has been so strong and so real that even the 2 and 20 fund managers don't understand it because it's been so easy. They haven't had to look at it. And now people are going, oh my God, why are we only making $9,000 a month and we owe $100,000? Well, because you didn't do your job. That's literally your job and you didn't do it. And that's just real.
How did they even get the financing though when the numbers are that
huge? Well, easy.
It clearly wasn't from the qualifying mortgage situation that we had invented after GFC.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Keep in mind, a lot of these so-called reforms after the so-called GFC
which was really a major recession in many, many ways, they swept a lot of the requirements under the rugs. And there are so many off-market dark pools. That's the big concern. Not the banks, not the big banks, but what's happening in private finance that's going on like the Wild West.
Agreed. And that's actually what started the situation that we face in private credit. It was the mortgage-backed securities or asset-backed securities or collateralizing obligations, whatever you want to call them. It was the concept of the ever-increasing financialization of portions of risk that somebody went, you know, I shared with the group the other day the analysis on an apartment building, and it was a 1.6% return on investment. That's what CLOs are made of, is, hey, it's positive. Well, sure, it's positive if rent always goes up, if cost always goes up, if expenses never go up, and at the current rate, and that never changes. Like, you're talking about some magic level conditions that need to exist for the situation to work. And it's my opinion that that's why every subsequent recession we've had has had wilder and wilder effects, not just on real estate, but on markets in general, right? And there's like two types of recessions. There's like the short, fast bursts, right? Like 2001 and 2020, where they should be a giant recession, and they are markets, like stock market terms. But then there's the other type, which are like the, we said GFC was 08-09, but in reality, it was a real estate recession from 2005 until 2014. It was 7 years of real estate getting absolutely destroyed, and the mortgage market was in tatters. That's what created the private credit system that we have in place now. And they're just repeating the same mistakes packaging asset-backed securities that all the banks did pre-GFC. It's Jimmy, Johnny, Susie, and Sally are paying a loan. Do you want some of it or not? Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
What is their credit rating? Oh, I'm pretty sure it's good. Here you go.
Exactly. It's got a 6 in front of it.
change the D to an L and keep it moving.
It's pretty curious. Well, guys, why don't we wrap this up tonight? I think we've got an idea how this works. I will be getting a headset adapter for my phone, because my current headset, I cannot find my female USB to C connector, but I'll get one real quick. That might make it a little bit clearer and better to speak to than you, instead of using these cell phone mics. And I'll figure out what's going on with Don and MacroWedge, why they didn't join us. I was hoping they would, but we can get that going. Once we get a few shows under our belt and get this smoothed out, I think it's time to start bringing guests on and bringing this point home, because you hit some great points tonight, Mr. A. You did also 6. You did 2, Axilla. I think as a group, we could bring some pretty heavyweight individuals into the room for discussions and have more in-depth discussions about what's going on in markets, especially in various fields. Everything we're talking about, we've seen before in history. There's nothing really new here.
Well, I think to that point, I think it's not just bringing other people in that are heavyweights or interesting. I think everybody in this group is interesting and is a heavyweight in their own regard. And I think that is part of what everybody has wanted, is just the truth about what's happening in the world, in the markets on a daily basis. And that in and of itself is something worth pursuing.
I absolutely agree. We have a very solid team.
Absolutely that.
And it's very... not just entertaining some of the things, the back and forth that we see in the discussion board, but the articles that are being put out online are absolutely fascinating reading, including 30 pages the other day.
Very good diversity.
That was something else.
That's for sure.
Well, the data is real too. It's all real data. It's like a lot of people. It's not like you can go, oh, this is your opinion. This is the data.
That's the part, isn't it? It's everyone's got an opinion. Everybody know what I'm talking about, right? Like,
yeah.
But the reality is, it's not my opinion. That's just the factual data. I can't argue it. I can't say it's not real. It is what it is.
Right, right. Like, I talk to different CFAs all the time, every day. And from the good ones, the ones that, you know, like, really know what they're doing, really know what they're talking about, they're all of them are, like, basically in agreement that, you know, it's just, like, the markets are just playing hot potato right now. Like, it really is just greater fool playing hot potato, and it just doesn't make a ton of sense, you know? You just got the Treasury just pumping money in on the cover of these, which one was it? The Economist, most recently, they had that picture of the guy with the American flag.
Strongman.
Yeah, yeah. Like, oh, the American exceptionalism economy. Like, take out the deficit spending and we're in a recession. You have, we're the number one economy. Without deficit spending, we're in a recession. You have China, who says that they have 5% GDP growth. Maybe they do. I don't know where it's coming from, if that's the truth. Like, where
they're allowed to speak the truth there if you value your life. So there's that.
Right.
The, like, the only growth that China is seeing is in exports to Asia and Africa.
I do not believe that they have 5% GDP growth. I don't even believe that they have positive GDP growth because, I mean, their property market is in the gutter. I had a client that's from China. He can't even sell his house in China. He said that there's just nobody buying and it's essentially almost worthless. And, you know, you got, they're knocking down those ghost cities. So, I mean, that's China, but then you got Germany in a recession, Japan in a recession. Like, these are the top four biggest economies. And I don't know.
Now that we're all interconnected, nobody escapes. It's
right. Exactly.
Dealing with the same realities.
Well, gentlemen, it's been an honor to speak with all of you finally.
Likewise.
And Kat, nice to talk to you too, even though you've vanished, I see. We will expand this audience rapidly. But I saw the message that they're going to schedule it for Friday at 9 p.m. next week, Macro Edge After Dark Edition 1. That'll be fantastic, and I'm ready to go if you guys are.
Yep, thanks for putting it together.
This was a quick and dirty just to test it and see how Spaces works. Nothing formal, more of a cigars and scotch discussion session. I think that's what we need to do to hash things out, test drive it. I always like to say that I'm the sandbox when it comes to testing. I'm used to doing it, so why not?
I'm not sure I want to be the sandbox, but, you know, I'm up for whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Thank all of you. And I also want to thank especially John Grodd listening in and standing up. Thanks for listening through the majority of this. And hopefully this was useful and the future versions are going to be even better.